Hello and welcome to the Doc Talk podcast. I'm Kenny Walter, Assistant Managing Editor of ACP Live. It is an interesting time in psychiatry. While traditional drugs like antipsychotics can be effective for many patients with depression or anxiety, there is still a large percentage of individuals who just don't respond, and the industry is now getting creative. Recreational drugs like marijuana, LSD, and ketamine have been studied for antidepressant effects in recent years and have been successful to varying degrees. And a major breakthrough happened in 2019 when the FDA approved esketamine, or Spravato, for the treatment of major depressive disorder. And since then, a variety of drugs have been studied for treatment-resistant depression, with psilocybin possibly being the most promising. Recently, during the Psychiatric Times World CME Congress in San Diego, Dr. John J. Miller joined me for a discussion that mostly centered on the use of cannabis and psilocybin to treat psychiatric disorders. Dr. Miller is the editor-in-chief of the Psychiatric Times. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Miller. Okay, Dr. Miller, to start things off, can you kind of give an overview of what the current research says in regards to using cannabis for psychiatric disorders?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a complicated question. One of the biggest issues currently is the fact that cannabis is a very vague and general term. And cannabis has been around for thousands of years, well over 6,000 years. And back in the early 60s, when it was being used recreationally in the United States, it was from the original plant. And those strains of cannabis had about 2% THC and 2% CBD, or cannabidiol. And it turns out that they're very, very different molecules. And so THC is the molecule that gives you the euphoria, but at the same time, it can kind of distort time. It's an antiemetic, but it also can cause anxiety, increases the risk of psychosis, especially in people who are vulnerable, either genetically or for other reasons. When a lot of people, when they talk or think about cannabis, they're thinking about THC. But the other component, cannabidiol, is a very different molecule. And it's actually oppositional to THC in a lot of ways. So in fact, instead of possibly causing psychosis, it treats psychosis. And instead of causing anxiety, it may help anxiety. And it has some anti-inflammatory properties. So the word cannabis, in my view, is not really a useful term. And when I read a study about cannabis in any kind of medical setting, it's not meaningful to me because I don't know what the ingredients of the cannabis used had in it. Was it 2% THC? Was it 30% THC? Did it have no cannabidiol? Was it high cannabidiol? And so a lot of the literature, because it doesn't differentiate the components of the, quote, cannabis, it's hard to draw evidence-based conclusions that we can then apply clinically.
Now, how do you combat, I don't want to say misinformation, but how do you combat that confusion over what the actual product that would work in these situations is?
Well, this is where education is so important. And when we look at the science of cannabis, if you were to extract all of the cannabinoids from the plant, there are over 100 molecules. And of those 100 molecules, only three of them have really been well characterized, and two of them being THC and CBD, and then a third. The other 97, we still really don't know a whole lot about. And so the first step would be, in my opinion, to do research that specifically is looking at purified THC versus purified CBD, and to drop the term cannabis from research trials and from conversations. When patients ask me about cannabis, it's like, I don't know. I don't know what you're smoking. I don't know what you're buying. And even in a lot of dispensaries, you know, the people who grow the products will share their opinions about what they do. But ultimately, what we need, in my view, is just like we regulate alcohol. And so if you go into a store and buy a bottle of tequila, you know the percentage, you know the purity, you know the ingredients. And in my view, we should be doing the same with the THC and CBD so that there's a predictability and research can be done based on a known entity, a known concentration of a product, and we know what the consequences of that are. So I don't feel as a physician that I have the information or the knowledge to be able to have a frank conversation about this general term cannabis, other than to say that the more THC, especially in a young developing brain, you know, ages up to age 25, that the more THC you smoke, the greater the likelihood of potentially irreversible cognitive impairment, and the greater the likelihood of increased risk of psychosis, especially up to 500% increase, especially if you're vulnerable.
Now, do you, with marijuana being more or less destigmatized and legalized in a bunch of states, and seems to be heading in a certain direction where it's being accepted in more and more, you know, regular life, do you think that, I guess, hurts patients who are treated with it? Because they might, if it's legal in a state, they might forego, say, therapy for the cheaper option of just going to the dispensary.
Yeah, so we have to be clear that we are not, as physicians, prescribing cannabis. And it's a really complicated and controversial area. We know that although a lot of our patients claim that cannabis has anti-anxiety properties and helps them sleep, we know that there are a lot of long-term risks of smoking cannabis, including low motivation, cognitive impairment, apathy, and that 10% of people get addicted to cannabis and actually can have a DSM-5 TR criteria for cannabis use disorder. So in my view, we should not be prescribing cannabis and not even talking about it as therapy or treatment, but educating our patients about it as a substance that people use, like cigarette smoking and like alcohol, and that it may complicate or undermine other treatments that we know are evidence-based, such as certain medications or psychotherapy. And so I think, again, it goes back to what we need is a larger federal input on educating people about the facts, and then us as healthcare providers knowing the facts and being able to have a meaningful conversation that will maximize a good outcome.
Now, switching over to psilocybin and psychedelics, it seems like in recent years there's been a big push from drug developers to really tackle treatment-resistant depression. Do you think psilocybin and other similar compounds could be the answer to this problem?
So that's another good question. And the simple answer is it's not going to be the answer, but it will be an answer. And so we know that treatment-resistant depression is a huge unmet need, and we have about 29 FDA-approved antidepressants. We have a lot of add-on treatments. We have a lot of psychotherapies, you know, sleep hygiene. There's lots and lots of treatment. And for some people who have not responded, using psilocybin in a controlled setting, which basically the clinical trials to date, and this currently phase 3 studies, is a pure concentration, and the individual will have two doses separated by 2 to 3 weeks. And before the first dose, and the day of the first dose, the day of the second dose, and after the second dose, they're meeting with a team of two highly trained psychotherapists who are experienced in a person under the influence of psilocybin. And so it will be used in a very controlled setting for patients who are treatment resistant, and For some people, it may be a really good choice to help cross the threshold to where they hopefully can have a life-changing move out of being stuck in a treatment-resistant depressed state.
Do you think the approval of, and I believe it was 2019, of esketamine kind of snowballed a lot of this research? Just getting that approved by the FDA means that something like psilocybin would hypothetically be approved as well?
No, I think you have to look at each drug independently. Now, esketamine, you're right, it was 2019. It's the one of the two active isomers of ketamine. And ketamine was FDA approved in 1970. And ketamine, when it was approved in 1970, was as an anesthetic. And serendipitously, in 2000 at Yale, some psychiatrists discovered that intravenous ketamine seemed to have robust antidepressant effects within 24 hours. And that led to a 10-year research endeavor by Janssen, who developed Spravato or esketamine, which is now FDA approved and has been used, but also is every dose is in the context of a REMS protocol, which monitors for safety and adverse events, etc. So it's the positive thing about esketamine is it brings what we call a RAD, a rapidly acting antidepressant, into the picture. So instead of waiting 4 to 6 weeks for our traditional antidepressants to work, we now have a well-established drug that for some patients can within 24 hours have a dramatic improvement, and for some patients that can be an enduring effect. We do have a lot of different drugs in the pipeline, and psilocybin is certainly one of them that, again, is already in a phase 3 development, and the other being MDMA, or common name ecstasy, which is being studied for PTSD, also with some excellent preliminary data. We have other drugs as well that have mechanisms outside of the monoamine system that seem to work faster, and collectively this group of novel agents and molecules will hopefully allow us to get people better quicker.
Now, we spoke about medical marijuana a little bit, but we spoke about it being destigmatized in popular culture. Do you think, you know, when you say, even though they're taking the part of ecstasy that has the drug effect, the recreational drug effect, out of it, do you think there's going to be stigma where people are going to fight back against having something like that approved by the FDA just because of more or less ignorance of not knowing what it is and what it can do?
In my experience is, I've been practicing psychiatry for 31 years, and no matter what drug I prescribe, or what present lecture I give, or what article I write, there will always be a segment of the population that totally disagrees with me and think I'm evil, and another a population that will get really excited, and another population that already is well-versed in some of what we say. So the bottom line is we want to approach it from a structured, safe, evidence-based clinical manner and show through studies what's the best way to utilize these molecules to help improve quality of life and treat disorders that continue to be challenging and treatment resistant for many patients.
Do you, obviously you said psilocybin is a answer to treatment resistant depression. Do you believe, you kind of have both sides where there are a lot of drugs being developed to try to handle this population, but there's probably going to be a lot more people with depression just based on the last 2.5 years, what we've gone through, and just people manifesting the stress. Do you believe if we have this conversation, let's say 5 years from now, we're going to have a pretty good handle of things, or do you think just the events of the last 2.5 years is going to just have a drastic impact on psychiatry in this country?
Yeah, so the history of psychiatry goes back to the history of human evolution in literally tens of thousands of years. and you see it creep up into all cultures and all countries in different ways. Currently in the United States, 1 out of 5 Americans will have at least one episode of what we call a unipolar major depressive episode. So that's pretty common, 1 in 5. Now certainly during the COVID-19 pandemic, those numbers have gone up. And myself and many of my colleagues have clearly seen that during these past 2.5 years, our patients that had symptoms, they've clearly gotten worse as a result of a lot of many factors of the pandemic. So depression has always been with us. It always will be. I think that it's important to increase awareness of it as a phenomena that is kind of part of the human condition, there's a wide range of presentations, from a simple episode maybe related to a death of a loved one or a loss of a job, versus some people who seem to have a more genetically predisposed or from some kind of a head injury or event, you know, have a harder to treat depression. The bottom line is identifying it early, treating it aggressively, and ideally preventing relapses. Because the more someone's depressed, the easier it is for them to get depressed in the future, and the more that depression is going to affect their function, their social connectedness, and their quality of life. So again, it goes back to destigmatizing psychiatric disorders and using all of our tools, including medications, therapies, good nutrition, exercise, sleep hygiene, social supports, all of these which have been shown to improve depression. And for some people, one or another of those approaches may be more appropriate.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Okay.